Oh, boy. Margaret, nice to hear you. And we'll just get started here. Good morning and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Larry Kay. I live in Chicago, and I'm going to be the host for the presentation today, which, in fact, today is Sunday, June 1st, 2025. Let me give you the share ID numbers for Friday, May 30th. They are the following: for the 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time meeting, that number is 22,481. That's 22481. For the 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time meeting on Friday, 22,482. That's 22482. This morning, A Vision for You presents What About Bob? Love our title. Our speaker is going to bring to life this story in the big book entitled Dr. Bob's Nightmare. She's going to thread that together with her experience, strength, and hope. And Rachel will do a beautiful job. She's also going to share maybe a little bit on the other approved literature, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. If you haven't read that, conference approved, it's nice. So how utterly miraculous it is that we have a way out, right, of this bitter morass, as it's called in the big book. Isn't it extraordinary what was divinely unleashed on the world starting in 1935? And AA, as you know, began in 1935 in Akron, Ohio, as the outcome of a meeting between New York stockbroker, which was Bill W., and Dr. Bob, an Akron surgeon. Both had been hopeless alcoholics, couldn't stay stopped before their meeting. So, you know, as we reflect on this fact, it goes without saying that we in the Fellowship of Overeaters Anonymous are indebted to so many giants that have come before us, really from the time the OA co-founders and pioneers came together, you know, to share this solution with others in the 1930s, all the way to the present day. Here we are, June 1st, 2025, right? And what binds us together way back then and even today is the common problem we share and the common solution that pulls us from the depths of this deadly, deadly disease. So, you know, we gather not only to reflect on our personal journeys within OA, but to honor the legacy of the giants who paved the way for our recovery, and there's still giants here. See, because from the moment the big book was penned, what you had was a coalition of visionaries, pioneers, dedicated individuals, just like today. And they laid back then they laid the foundation for a movement that has saved countless lives. Their experiences, their insights, we hold dear today. And you know, as we explore the rich history of AA and its imprint on Overeaters Anonymous, you know, I always want to remember the wisdom imparted by those who came before us. And we're going to learn about one of those individuals today, because they faced struggles as we did, and with bravery and courage and vulnerability as well. And their stories serve as a guiding light that reminds us of the power of cultivating a relationship with a power greater than ourselves. And unity and singleness of purpose, as I'm mindful of, is what separates us from the likes of other movements, like the Oxford Group movement, which you're familiar with. It was once so prominent, but eventually it faded away. And why did it? Well, historians, over time, from what I can tell, have been pretty clear on the primary reasons. They got away from a singleness of purpose, got into hands into other things. And the message that was delivered also gave rise to divisiveness that fostered exclusion, exclusivity rather than inclusion, inclusivity. And these all contributed to the decline in the eventual disappearance of these, at least that prominent spiritual movement. It was huge. And if we think it can never happen to AA or OA, I believe is short-sighted. But if we carry a message of inclusion and tolerance while remaining firm, of course, on what the text means to us, how miraculous it is that God enables us to offer the same grace and mercy to others that was gifted to us. So as we lead into this, these amazing messengers to a man and a woman exemplified something profound. And that is that a firm, undiluted message of hope like Dr. Bob's, was never an angry message. It wasn't a belittling message. He was never unkind to others, as far as I've studied. Attraction rather than promotion means so much more than avoiding publicity. It extends to how we carry this message. So sincere humility is so powerfully attractive. It was in Dr. Bob and the, to the still sick and suffering addict. They're on the line right now. We have to keep that in mind. That's what separates us from a sales organization pushing product. What we push is love and tolerance and a clear message. So with that, joining us this morning to share with us on Dr. Bob's nightmare and some other details is Rachel Kay. Rachel is a recovered compulsive overeater, beloved in this group. She resides in Indiana. She's dedicated to our 12-step way of life, and she's committed to carrying a message of hope to our fellowship. And so it's with great appreciation that we welcome Rachel Kay to the line this morning. Hey, Rachel, good morning to you.
Good morning, Larry. I have to ask, can I be heard okay?
You can. You're coming through terrific.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that introduction, Larry. Hi, my name is Rachel Kay. I am a recovered compulsive overeater in Noblesville, Indiana. And I first want to say that I've done a special edition once before. And last time I just worked from an outline. And this time I wrote out more of what I was going to say because of the material, because I'm going to talk about like some historical stuff. I wanted to do it justice. I wanted to do justice to the history, of AA and some of the material. So you will hear me read some things. And I know that can be annoying sometimes to be read to, but I just wanted to be able to present stuff accurately. And also I want to say, I'm going to try and I am not perfect, but I'm going to try to define terms and things because I want to welcome the newcomer or the returner. But if you're kind of new or in your first few months or whatever of the program, I know when I came in, I felt like people were talking in code, like they would refer to things or books or terms or whatever. And I was like, what are they talking about? I need, these people are speaking a different language. So I'm going to try as best I can to define terms, which that'll be redundant for people who've been here a long time. But I think it's important that we, like Larry was saying, that our message is clear and that we define some jargon because we do use a lot of jargon. And that's kind of, makes us feel like we belong. But I also need to be aware of, that I want to be understood. So also, I hope I don't get into trouble with the copyright lawyers regarding barring my title from a Bill Murray movie, for those of you who are old enough to remember What About Bob? But hopefully not, because my share has nothing to do with Bill Murray or that movie. I titled it this because I've always had a special affection and an affinity for the co-founder of AA, Dr. Robert Smith. But you'll notice that while Bill Wilson, the first AA, while his story does fall within those first 164 pages that we talk about of the big book, Dr. Bob's Nightmare, which is the sort of the corresponding story of the second AA, it does not fall within those first 164 pages. It's in the part of the stories, the section that has the stories of the early AAs. In fact, after Leah asked me to speak and I decided on my topic, I texted her and I asked, is it okay to talk about this chapter in the big book, Dr. Bob's Nightmare, since it comes after the first 164 pages? And thankfully she said yes. And I say thankfully because I already liked my title and I already had my topic. And so I'm going to talk about Dr. Bob, his story, and his influence that he had on my recovery, even though he died 20 years before I was even born. I'm going to talk about how I relate to Dr. Bob before he recovered, how I relate to his story post-recovery, and then I'm going to talk about two main principles, which to me embody what his life after getting sober was all about. And as Larry mentioned, in addition to using the chapter in the big book that I already mentioned, Dr. Bob's Nightmare, I'm also going to draw from an AA conference-approved book published, like, I think it was 1980, called Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. So if you are interested in Dr. Bob and the history of AA in general, especially the history in Ohio, the evolution away from the Oxford group that Larry mentioned, et cetera, I would highly recommend it. But I don't want my share to be just a history lesson. My primary purpose, is to carry the message to the compulsive overeater who still suffers. So learning about Dr. Bob is only meaningful, at least to me, if I can relate it to my own struggle and my own recovery and to whatever it is I'm dealing with today, right now, at this moment. When I first opened the big book, I could not relate to these guys. I was like, what, you know, stockbroker and, what does this have to do with me? So I was lucky enough that I had people who were able to crack open the big book and make it relevant to me. So that's what I will try to do. And also I want to say, incidentally, that when I point out similarities between my story and Dr. Bob's, I am in no way comparing my contributions to the Fellowship of OA to his enormous contribution to the founding of AA. But since I've heard people talk about how useful it is for us to read, and I have my sponsees do this sometimes, to read Bill's story and determine how we ate like Bill drank and how we think like Bill thought, I figured maybe it would be helpful to do the same with Dr. Bob's story. So give me 1 second, I need to get a drink of water. Okay. So on the face of it, Dr. Bob and I have very little in common. He was a proctologist. I am not, kind of grateful for that. And we had very different experiences growing up and have different drugs of choice. His is alcohol, or was alcohol, minus food. But the similarities are greater than you may think. So his drinking torpedoed his academic career in early life, although he eventually did graduate from medical school before getting sober. On page 174 of the big book, he says about one instance, when I went in to write the examinations, this is when he was in school, my hand trembled so I could not hold a pencil. I passed in at least 3 absolutely blank books. Well, at least he showed up for his exams. Most of the time during my first attempt at college, undergrad, I did not show up for class at all because I was either binging or hungover from a binge. And mind you, I had gotten into a pretty good school. I did eventually graduate from undergrad and actually graduate school, although unlike Dr. Bob, I was not able to do this until I got abstinent. Our respective addictions devastated our professional lives, our personal lives, and our health. And another thing is, both of us thought that exterior circumstances would solve our problems. For Bob, it was prohibition. He says on page 175 of the big book that with the passing of the 18th Amendment, that was the Prohibition Amendment, he felt safe, which of course he wasn't, because he found a way to get alcohol. A lot of people did, if you've ever read about prohibition. For me, the external circumstance was the right guy, the right friends, the right anything. I would think to myself, okay, I got asked out by such and such guy. There is no way I will overeat now because I want to be thin, so he'll want to keep going out with me. But that never worked. On page 21 in the big book, in the chapter More About Alcoholism, they give the description of the alcoholic, quote, "He has a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept," end quote. I used to think that the reason I continued to binge, even when I got the perfect guy or was accepted into like a particular social group or, you know, group of friends or clique, was because I was self-sabotaging. But I don't think that's true. For me personally, I do not believe in the concept of self-sabotage. And this is just not just for me. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. Why would I purposely, just for the reason of sabotaging myself, you know, undo something that I want? for me, the reason I did those things was because I still lacked, the reason why I would go ahead and binge, even when exterior things depended on me not binging, was because I still lacked a relationship with a power greater than myself that it talks about in the steps. No human power, no circumstance will ever prevent me from picking up. Only a relationship with God will prevent me from picking up. Likewise, if that relationship with God is strong, there is no human power or no circumstance, nothing that can happen in my life that will cause me to pick up as long as I have that relationship with God. So speaking of God, another thing that Dr. Bob and I have in common before we recovered is that we both did believe in God, but we were both unable to apply this belief in such a way that would solve our drinking or, for me, my eating problem. So that book that I mentioned, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, talks at length about Dr. Bob's involvement with the Oxford Group. And for those of you who don't know, the Oxford Group was, and this is a quote from Dr. Bob and Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. And by the way, I'm sorry I don't have page numbers for Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. I read it on Kindle on an e-book version. And as for those of you who read ebooks, the pages are off. But this is a quote. The Oxford Group was a spiritual movement that sought to recapture the power of first century Christianity in the modern world. Members of the Oxford Group sought to achieve spiritual regeneration by making a surrender to God through rigorous self-examination, confessing their character defects to another human being, making restitution for harm done to others, and giving without thought of reward, end quote. So that sounds kind of familiar, right? But Dr. Bob did not get sober in the Oxford Group. Dr. Bob didn't even talk about his alcoholism to the members of the Oxford Group until a few years after he and his wife Ann joined. Dr. Bob was trying to do all of the things that I listed that the Oxford Group prescribed, but with one exception. So in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, it talks about his and Bill's common experience in the Oxford Group, because Bill had joined as well. He had joined in New York. Dr. Bob specifies exactly what it was in those things that he omitted. So, quote, Bill had acquired their idea of service. I had not, end quote. Likewise, before I got recovered, I was in OA for 15 years before I got recovered and abstinent. I know I must have heard lots of people talk about service. I know I did. And I certainly heard the 12-step read every time I went to a meeting because they read the steps. The problem was I honestly thought that service applied to other people. I thought that that was something other people do, not me. I never committed to service, even service that I would have qualified for because it had no abstinence requirement, because I didn't trust myself to be available to do it. I was thinking, what if I signed up to set up chairs at the meeting next week, but I don't make it to the meeting because I was binging, which often happens. I treated OA like a self-help program. And I've said this on meetings before, if you guys know me, but I'll say it again. OA is not a self-help program. It's an other help program. That is the reason that Bill and Bob stayed sober, because they helped other alcoholics, like immediately, like not after a month. They sought to do it immediately, but I'm getting kind of ahead of myself. So in the chapter, A Vision for You, in the big book, you can read the events that led up to how Bill and Dr. Bob met, the events that led Dr. Bob to getting sober and thus the birth of AA. So Bill is at a hotel, the Mayflower Hotel, and he wants to drink very badly. He comes almost literally to a fork in the road. He can either, and you can actually see pictures, like there's a photograph in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers of the Mayflower Hotel and that church directory that he was looking at. It's very cool. So he can either choose to go into the bar at this hotel and get drunk, or he can dial a number at random in the church directory and ask a random clergyman if he knew of any alcoholics he could help. I won't go into all the details. There's a lot of historians on this call, or, you know, several who can tell you the details. But there were many coincidences. all the stars lined up in a perfect way. One coincidence led to another, and that culminated in an evening where an initial conversation between Dr. Bob and Bill that was supposed to last only 15 minutes. Dr. Bob said, oh, to this guy, only 15 minutes, and it lasted over 5 hours. But Dr. Bob only stayed sober 3 weeks after that. So here he has this like big shattering conversation with Bill, and he stayed sober, but only for 3 weeks. After that, he went to Atlantic City for a professional conference where he like went on a bender. And when he finally made it back to Ohio, Bill was sent to take care of him. Bill actually gave Dr. Bob his last drink. On the top of page 180 of the big book, Dr. Bob says that Bill gave him some drinks that night, likely to stop the shakes, because, you know, severe alcoholism, you know, you go through withdrawal if you stop abruptly. And he gave him a bottle of beer the next morning, and that was Dr. Bob's last drink. Dr. Bob says, at the time he writes Dr. Bob's nightmare, he's been sober for 4 years. Just 1 second, I need another drink. So you see, like, we can have this amazing spiritual experience that is transformative, but there needs to be something more substantial to keep us recovered. After 15 years in OA, I had a pretty amazing spiritual experience. I won't go into my whole story. A lot of you heard it. But basically, it involved me moving to a city, San Francisco, where I knew only one person, getting kicked out of where I was living, getting a friendship divorce with that one person that I knew in the city who happened to be my best friend, and having all my stuff stranded in a moving van on the side of the road somewhere for over a month. So during those few days, I started to rely on God for everything, every minute of the day, and I had a bit of a white light experience. And I stayed abstinent for 6.5 months after that. But then I relapsed for about 6 months, and I finally got abstinent, this current abstinence, on June 23rd of 2000. So you've heard the expression, I can't stay clean on yesterday's shower. White light experiences are wonderful, and I'm not taking them lightly. But if you've never had one, and a lot of people have it, or if you never have one, I would not get too jealous of those of us who have. A sustained relationship with God is the only thing that will keep me abstinent one day at a time, not that initial profound discovery of God or God's care for me. Likewise, even though those 5+ hours that Bob initially spent with Bill, I imagine, I wasn't there, but I imagine they were pretty intense, Dr. Bob still went out and drank after 3 weeks. On page 85, when talking about step 10, the big book says, even if we are free of the craving, we, quote, we are not cured of alcoholism. What we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities, end quote. So, okay, what it's like now for both of us. Speaking about the craving, let's talk about why I relate to Dr. Bob after he got sober. On page 180 of the big book, Dr. Bob talks about his gratitude for his new life. So I'm quoting here. It is a most wonderful blessing to be relieved of the terrible curse with which I was afflicted. My health is good, and I have regained my self-respect and the respect of my colleagues. My home life is ideal, and my business is as good as can be expected in these uncertain times. That's the end of the quote. Yet, okay, on the very next page, he says this is the next quote. Unlike most of our crowd, I did not get over my craving for liquor much during the first 2.5 years of abstinence. It was almost always with me, but at no time have I been anywhere near yielding. I used to get terribly upset when I saw my friends drink, and I knew I could not, but I schooled myself to believe that though I once had the same privilege, I had abused it so frightfully that it was withdrawn. So it doesn't behoove me to squawk about it, for after all, nobody ever had to throw me down and pour liquor down my throat, end quote. Okay, so what gives? Dr. Bob says that he has been relieved, in that first paragraph that I read, he's been relieved of this terrible curse and considers that a blessing. Yet he, the co-founder of AA and partially responsible for what has been called the most important spiritual movement of the 20th century, still has cravings for the first 2.5 years he was sober. Was he not truly recovered during that time? My opinion, and this is only my opinion, you can talk to other people, is that arguing about whether Dr. Bob or me or someone else is recovered or recovering or just abstinent or dry but not recovered is a waste of time. I just don't see the point. I believe that while we all share a common disease, it comes in many strengths and varieties, just like most diseases, like cancer. Like you can have stages 1 through 4 of cancer, or cancer can affect different parts of your body. Maybe the craving part of Dr. Bob's disease was an especially strong strain, just like a strain of bacteria that is particularly resistant to antibiotics. Some people have the craving immediately relieved when they take step 1, or when they take step 5, or when they take step 12. My experience was much like Dr. Bob's. My withdrawal during my first several months of abstinence was awful. It was horrible. I mean, I was grateful to be abstinent, but it was not fun. At many times, I was sure I was going to go out and eat, and I was generally surprised when I would wake up in the morning abstinent. I'm so grateful. Oh, my God. I never want to lose that feeling. There were evenings when I thought, if this day lasts another minute, I am going to binge, so I'm going to bed. And I went to bed early, sometimes at like 7 or 8 at night. And it took a long time for me to get any neutrality with food. But I did get neutrality with food eventually. However, I still feel sad sometimes when my meals are over after almost 25 years of abstinence. Does this mean I am not working my program or there's something wrong with my relationship with God? Maybe. And I certainly need to examine and determine if I'm doing anything that is shutting me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. Am I being dishonest about something? Is there a fear or a resentment that I haven't inventoried or something that, you know, I need to speak with another compulsive overeater about or get honest about with myself, with God? But most of the time, I just figure I have the body and the mind of a compulsive overeater. A compulsive eater of my type and with my particular strain, I like eating and I don't like stopping eating. But, you know, when the meal ends, if it's one of those occasions where I'm sad when it ends, I get up, I brush my teeth, and 30 minutes later or less, I'm fine. I'm totally fine. And like Dr. Bob, I am grateful to have been relieved of the terrible curse with which I was afflicted. I can honestly say I today have a life that is beyond my wildest dreams. So I've told you about the similarities between Dr. Bob and me, why I find him relatable. Now I'd like to talk about why I find him so inspiring. And that has to do with two of the things that he practiced in his recovery, two of what I would like to call like Dr. Bob's hallmarks, like trademark Dr. Bob. And the first one of these is humility. I think he shows humility when he talks about the privilege in that paragraph that I was quoting, the privilege of drinking being withdrawn from him. He doesn't whine about how hard it was that he still had the craving for 2.5 years and that most of the other people in AA didn't have that craving. Like he was surrounded by people who were completely neutral and he was still like suffering with that craving every day, even though he wasn't coming close to drinking. In the book, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, it recounts that Dr. Bob had this plaque on his desk defining humility, and here's what the plaque says, or said. Perpetual quietness of heart. It is to have no trouble. It is never to be fretted or vexed, irritable or sore, to wonder at nothing that is done to me, to feel nothing done against me. It is to be at rest when nobody praises me, and when I am blamed or despised, it is to have a blessed home in myself where I can go in and shut the door and kneel to my Father in secret and be at peace, as in a deep sea of calmness when all around and about is seeming trouble. So, wow, you talk about what an order. When Dr. Bob talks about not having any trouble, or when the plaque says not having any trouble, I don't think it's talking about outside circumstances. Dr. Bob and his wife, and along with Bill and his wife, went through all sorts of economic and other hardships when AA was getting off the ground. To me, when he talks about, or when the plaque talks about having no trouble, it's like the word difficulties in the third step prayer. So on page 63 of the big book, in the third step prayer, we ask God, take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. So I don't think this means I'm supposed to ask God to make people at work nicer or pay my credit card bill or make my neighbors quieter. By difficulties in the prayer, I think what I'm being asked to do is to ask God to help me with my sick reactions to those things, whether it be my reaction is compulsively overeating or reacting to people or you know, fear or resentment, whatever it is. Having no trouble means not being troubled when the stuff that happens in life happens. The inscription also says to be at rest when nobody praises me. Dr. Bob was a well-respected surgeon in his town, and in the process of making his amends when he was working what was to be the steps, I mean, they weren't the steps at that time, they hadn't written them down, but in the process of making amends to his staff, he admitted his alcoholism. He risked his reputation and his livelihood and let go of trying to manage what people thought of him because he knew he had to go to any length to get and stay sober. That kind of humility is inspiring to me. So, and I need to remember it. That kind of humility, like when I'm doing something like spending an hour on a one paragraph email, like I did the other day to someone at work, because I'm trying to word it perfectly and in such a way that I look good. That is not humility. So I recently learned a new acronym, LAVA. I am addicted to LAVA, which stands for love, attention, validation, and acceptance. LAVA for me is as much of a drug for me as food. It might be more of a drug for me. No, I will never, ever have enough of it if I am looking for it from other people. But I have an unlimited supply of LAVA when I am in contact with my higher power. I have it from God. I don't need to seek it from people. I think that's what Dr. Bob's plaque was talking about when it mentions a peaceful place where he can kneel to his Father. So the other principle that to me embodies Dr. Bob, and which is so inspirational to me, and I aspire, you know, to be like him, is his service. On page 171 in the big book, in the introduction to Dr. Bob's Nightmare, it says, he carried the AA message to more than 5,000 alcoholic men and women. Dr. Bob in the Good Old Timers talks about how alcoholics would come see him in his office or at the hospital, and he always had time for him. And I don't know if any of you have tried to make a doctor's appointment lately with a specialist, which Dr. Bob was, or have sat in a waiting room lately reading magazines. You know that doctors tend to be pretty busy. So it's not like Dr. Bob was helping these 5,000 people in his spare time or because he had a lot of spare time or he was bored. I am assuming this was not convenient for him. You know, he had his work, but yet he found time for them. So he explains the four reasons why he does this much service on pages 180 and 181 of the big book. This is a quote. I spend a great deal of time passing on what I learn to others who want and need it badly. I do it for four reasons. Number one, sense of duty. Number two, it is a pleasure. Number three, because in doing so, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. And number four, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. End quote. So I can definitely get on board with number one, sense of duty, and number three, because in doing so, I am paying my debt to the man or woman who took time to pass it on to me. Okay, for number two, yes, it is a pleasure. Often it is to see sponsees transform or to feel part of the group because I'm doing service at a meeting, like reading the steps or giving out candles. But I have to admit that if I waited to feel like I'm doing service, there are occasions when I would wait forever. For example, last week I was really stressed out because I hadn't finished preparing for this special edition, and I was feeling scared and I was feeling resentful about having to do it. Now, mind you, Leah did not come to my house brandishing a gun and holding it to my head when she asked me to do the special edition. I agreed to it. I volunteered. But I was dreading finishing preparing for it. And then God stepped in and did something really amazing. So I happened to be digging through a drawer trying to find, I can't even remember, and I came upon an old journal from 1985, which was right when I came into program. And in the journal, I had written about how I cannot stop binging, how resolving not to binge wasn't working, how I am so desperate and I don't know how to stop. It was like I could smell the misery and the hopelessness on those pages. It was like frightening how quickly it brought me back to that feeling 40 years ago of just how I had felt at 15 years old. There's absolutely nothing I wouldn't do not to have to go back into the hell I was in when I wrote those journal entries, including preparing for this talk. And so I was like, okay. And I sat down and I finished preparing for the talk. And that brings me to number 4 on Dr. Bob's list. I don't, where he says, every time I do it service, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. For me, I don't try to carry the message because I am morally superior or running to be Pope. They already got somebody for that job anyway. I do it because every time I do it, every time I do service, I'm taking out some of that priceless insurance that Dr. Bob talks about against a possible slip or a relapse. So I can't talk about Dr. Bob's nightmare without mentioning probably my favorite part of his story, which are the last two paragraphs. They're like a money-back guarantee that this program works. Before I got recovered and abstinent, I would get very freaked out when we would read how it works at the very first part of meetings. So for those of you who aren't familiar with it, because we read other stuff now at the start of most meetings, the preamble and other material, which is great. I love it. But we used to read how it works a lot. And if you're not familiar with it, it starts on page 58 of the big book, and the first line says, "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path," end quote. And I would say to myself, aha, rarely. So this doesn't work for everyone. I must be one of those people who fails. That's why I can't get abstinent. And of course, I completely ignored the second line, the line that comes right after it, which says, quote, "Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves." So as long as I have the ability to be honest with myself, number one, and I completely give myself to this simple program, I will recover. And then Dr. Bob in his story talks about how completely I need to give myself to this simple program in his last few sentences. So he says, "If you really and truly want to quit drinking liquor or compulsively overeating or whatever it is you're doing with food for good and all, and sincerely feel that you must have some help, we know we have an answer for you. It never fails, not rarely, never fails if you go about it with one half the zeal you have been in the habit of showing when you were getting another drink. Your Heavenly Father will never let you down." So, Larry, with that, I'm going to pass. That's all I got. Thank you for letting me share, and we can open for Q&A, I guess.
Well, great. Rachel, just want to say thank you for your thoroughly humble and relatable integration of this chapter with your experience, strength, and hope. A beautiful addition to our Vision for You archive. So thank you. And which is actually a good segue. Let me give you the share ID for Rachel. Okay. That number is 22,483. That's 22483. And we'll now transition to a Q&A phase of the presentation this morning where you can pose a question to Rachel. So get ready for that. But before we do that, also hang out till the end of the recorded period in which case we will ask Rachel for her contact information, where if you feel more comfortable reaching out to her or sort of offline, that's the way to do it. So with that in mind, press star one, give me your first name and last initial. Who has a question for Rachel?
Mary Lee R. in Eugene, Oregon.
Mary Lee.
Marcel F.
Marcel F.
Ann A.
Hi, Ann.
Hanayeta R.
Hi, Hanayeta. We gotcha.
Who
else?
Krista S., Illinois.
Krista S., as in Sam?
Yes.
I think I got it. Okay, thanks, Krista. Who else? Okay, well, we have a good start. Let me tell you who I heard again. I heard Mary Lee. Sure, Elaine, I can put you on the end there. Okay, so let's stop with Elaine. And so we have a good starting point. We should have plenty of time if there's other questions following this group. So we have in this particular order, Mary Lee, Marcel, Anne, Hanayeta, Krista, and Elaine. And the only thing I would ask you, starting with Mary Lee, is just give your last initial so people, if you happen to be on the list, people can look you up and where you're calling from. So let's start. Everyone, please mute except Mary Lee R. Good morning to you, Mary Lee.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, all my pod mates. God morning. Oh, thank you. Could you very slowly say the four things for lava, please?
Sure. Hi, Mary Lee. So they were love, attention. Love, attention, validation, and acceptance.
And how has that worked in your life?
So, and this is, it's very cool. I heard this on, it was a outside, well, it's another program, but I heard that on another podcast. How it has worked in my life is realizing, because also I will tell you, maybe I'm oversharing, but I'm in a kind of a new relationship. And I realized, oh my God, I am addicted to this. Like I get a hit off of this. From other people. And I realized like it's never enough. So once I started accepting that principle that I am addicted to that, and that that is the opposite of humility, because humility is not thinking less of myself. It's thinking of myself less. And anytime I'm seeking those four things, love, attention, validation, and acceptance from people, I am thinking about me. It's basically selfishness. It's me, or self-seeking. And so anytime I'm seeking that from humans, I'm not in humility. But when I can let go of that and realize, okay, I'm looking for my drugs, just like I'm seeking food, and instead turn to my higher power and remember, no, I get it from God. That's my source, not people. Then, you know, that's just been really helpful to me to shift that. And then I can get into humility. Then I can do what I feel is, or what I hope, and my understanding of what God's will is for me.
Thanks for the question, Mary Lee. Okay, next up we have Marcel F., followed by Ann A. Good morning, Marcel.
This is Marcel F. from Manitoba, Canada. Can I be heard?
You can.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Rachel, for that beautiful, inspiring message. I learned so much about Bob and for your service. My question is, you talked about a sustained relationship with God. Can you just speak a little bit more about that? What is your, what are the things that you do or how you are to maintain a sustained relationship with God? Thank you.
Oh, thank you for the question, Marcel, my dear, dear, dear Marcel. so, yeah, that means it's just like pending any other friendship. It's people always talk about, quality time. It's also quantity time. I have to, which doesn't mean that I meditate for 2 hours. I'm not a good meditator. I meditate for 10 minutes. But I do take quiet time in the morning where I meditate for 10 minutes. I just sit. And if my mind wanders, it wanders, it's fine. I do writing in the morning. I actually do, for me, my 10 steps in the morning, I handwrite it because it's much more from the heart for me when I handwrite. I read some passages from spiritual literature. I read whatever paragraph that we're going to read on vision that day. But then throughout the day, I try to check in with God, just like I would. I think I've said this before. I may have even said this in my last special edition, that I heard, I had a sponsee, and his sponsee said something that really stuck with me. I should be checking in with God as often as I am checking my phone, because certainly God is more important than whatever is on my phone. And so I can't say that I stick to that, but that constant, continual contact. And it talks about in step 10, many times each day, thy will be done. And of course, I have to mention, I weigh and measure my food. I commit my food, I have to make nourishing my body in the proper way of utmost importance, because those things will immediately block me off from the sunlight of the spirit. But I can only do that by keeping the conscious contact with God. And if there are other things that are blocking me from God, other behaviors, I have to be honest with myself and other people about that. So, I would say that is definitely a big part of it.
Thank you so
thanks,
much.
Thanks, Marcel. thanks, Marcel, for the question. Okay, next up we have Anne A., followed by Hannah Yetta R. Good morning, Anne.
Oh, thank you so much, Larry, and thank you so much, Rachel. It was really, truly inspiring. And actually, the first fellow asked the question, and so just to piggyback off of that, and thank you so much for your honesty, and I just love Dr. Bob's humility. How did his beautiful wife, Anne, influence his practice, do you think?
So I am not an expert on Anne, but it did talk about Anne in this book. She was, very sort of patient and accepting. I mean, she wasn't a saint, but she also, at first she was kind of reluctant, to join with Lois in Lois was Bill Wilson's wife and basically started the whole concept of Al-Anon, but then she was like full into it with talking with, accepting alcoholics into their home and talking with the wives. And so, I think that support was instrumental. But I will say I am certainly not a expert on Anne. I know that I just believe that there was some kind of divine force working in this whole establishment of AA, not only with the two men, but their spouses, that they were able to help so many alcoholics that came to them.
Thanks for the question, Anne. Okay, next up we have Hannah Yetta R, followed by Krista S. Hannah Yetta, good morning to you.
Good morning, Larry. And good morning, Rachel. Thank you so much. Wow, it really was touching. I love the story. I haven't read it in many, many, many years, but I also always look to the fact that he did suffer for 2.5 years with still, having urges, but didn't take it up. So, but my question to you. You said, if I have it right, you said that you don't believe in self-sabotage. And I was wondering if you had ever thought of the fact, and why would anybody self-sabotage? I think that's what you said. But what about the person who really just hates themselves so much that they don't feel like when they get so well and they get so happy and everything in their life is going so smoothly that they just can't stand it because they don't think they deserve this wonderful life. And so they pick up. Have you ever thought about that person? That person's me, by the way.
Hi, Henrietta. Thank you so much for the question. And yeah, and I can only speak from my own experience. So, you know, that this is what is true for me, that the concept of self-sabotage and that whole thing is, you know, it's because I don't love myself, didn't work for me. And the concept for me of learning to love myself, it sounds good, but it never worked for me. Like, why would I, when I was in the food, why in the world would I love myself? If somebody else was doing this to me, I wouldn't love them. Like, there was no reason to love myself, you know, because I was doing these horrible things to myself. What does work for me, rather than, I feel like it was putting the cart before the horse. It was like, love yourself and then, you know, you'll stop doing those things. It never worked for me. What did work for me and what does work for me is this concept. I believe, when I took step two, I believe in a God that is so kind and loves me like so much that I can't even fathom. And then in step three, I commit to do what I think God would have me do. So I'm committing to think like God thinks, or how I imagine, and to do what God would do, even though I'm not going to come close. So if God loves me that much, then if I am following God's will, I am not going to sabotage myself. I am going to love myself, not just for the sake of loving myself, but because it's God's will. I'll put it this way. It doesn't matter what I think of me. It matters what God thinks of me. And God thinks I'm awesome. God loves me. That's what's important. So I had to let go of what, you know, worrying about, you know, do I love myself or not? And like I say, this is just my experience. I had to stop worrying about whether I love myself or not, because it just, as much as I tried, it never worked. I had to think about, okay, what does God think of me? Okay, God thinks I'm wonderful. Okay, then I'm okay. If God's good with me, then things are good. So anyway, that's kind of my interpretation of this step. So I'll pass with that.
Thanks, Henrietta. Okay, Krista S., you're up next, followed by Elaine. Good morning to you.
Hi, thank you so much. That was a fantastic lead. I am wondering two things. The first thing is, you mentioned honesty from that passage in the Big Book. I relate to very deeply. The people who cannot recover, people who won't fully give themselves to the program, or constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. What did it look like for you to start being honest with yourself? And then the other question is, what do you think were some mistakes you made in those first 15 years of lacking abstinence? Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Elaine, for the question. So being honest with myself finally was saying, I am never going to solve this problem the way I'm doing it. So I won't tell my whole story, but I was living in an apartment in Houston, Texas, and the apartment was disgusting. And being honest with myself was saying, it was also saying that I was never going to kill myself, because my trap door was suicide. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to kill myself. So I have to live like this. That was finally, I mean, I know this is all kind of brutal for a Sunday morning, but it was being honest and saying, oh my God, I'm going to live like this. I'm going to live in this filth, you know, and I don't have that trap door. What I'm doing is not working. It is totally not working. I need to get honest with other people. I had to tell, you know, a friend, I had to tell my parents, this is what's going on. I need to radically change my life. And I did. And if you want to call me, I'll tell you like what I did. I actually moved geographically. It was a whole thing. So that was getting honest with myself that even though I was going to meetings, what I was doing was not working, and that, you know, I was going to have to keep on living like this for the rest of my life until the food finally killed me, or I just died of old age, which was, I mean, it was horrible. Some of the mistakes that I made in those first 15 years that I didn't get abstinent, I wish I could say, okay, it was this one thing, and then I changed that, and then I got abstinent. Because I think abstinence is grace. It is not something I do or something I achieve. It is totally a gift from God that, you know, I receive. But I have to make myself fit and ready to receive that gift. So I know a big one was service, that I honestly thought service is for people, is for other people. It's not for me, because I'm just too sick to do any kind of service. To put up chairs or to do any of that. So I didn't. I didn't connect with people at all in the meetings. So even though fellowship isn't the program, I cannot do the steps, you know, without the fellowship, you know, because then I'm isolating again. So I did not do service. And also there were some foods that I wasn't there. You know, this is also an allergy of the body. And I always said, you know, well, I binge on everything. So how can I, you know, I don't need to eliminate certain foods because I have binged on literally everything. But I had to look honestly and say, okay, yes, that is true. I've binged on Brussels sprouts. I've binged on lettuce. But those aren't the things that I go to first, you know, and I had to look at the things that I go to first, and I had to eliminate those things. So that was part of it too. So anyway, yeah, that's kind of, I hope I answered both of your questions, Elaine.
Actually, I think that was Krista. Did I have that right? Or did I miss
that? Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Krista?
No, yeah, I think so. Because I think Elaine is next. Elaine, you're up with the question for Rachel. That's okay. Maybe I got it wrong. Was there an Elaine or was that Elaine? I had Krista. Elaine, if you're on the line, press star one.
That was Krista.
Okay. I might have been
your response.
Can you hear me?
Okay. I can hear you now. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Elaine, good morning.
Thank you so much. Good morning. And thank you, Larry, for your service. And Rachel, just so helpful, so helpful. And I also want to thank all the people behind the scenes that are doing the technology, because it's like, it's just such a gift to have all the resources that we have from this, you know, from Vision. And I want to say that, first of all, I binged on Brussels sprouts, but it wasn't the Brussels sprouts. It was that they were roasted, and it was the oil and salt on the Brussels sprouts. So that's something to think about also. My question is, I'm so happy that you referenced Dr. Bob's humility plaque. I say it every morning. I made one little change, but I say it every morning. And could you, I missed if you said it was in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers or somewhere else, but if you could mention where we can find this, because I wanted to share it with people, the original, not before I changed it, and I'm not sure. And the second question I have is, you mentioned and I so totally get it, that each of us has experiences this disease in somewhat different ways. And but I find when food calls me, I think I'm just, oh, so spiritual and everything is going so great. And all of a sudden, food will call me in the evening, always in the evening. And what I find is, there's a 10-step I have to do. I think of, well, it's just in the first month, or it's just in the first year, or whatever it is. And but there is, every single time for me, there's a disturbance, there's a fear, there's something little perhaps. It's telling me, when food is calling, it's telling me, stop what you're doing, get off the top, because it's in the evening, my husband and I are watching TV, get away from the television and figure out what is bothering you. So I don't know if you've experienced that, but please share with us. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Elaine, right? And by the way, Krista, if you're still on the line, I'm so sorry. Like, I think I called you by the wrong name twice. So this is Elaine. Elaine, thank you for your questions. First of all, yes, the plaque that I talked about, that is in the book, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, that is conference-approved AA literature. I'm sorry, I can't tell you the page number where it is because I was reading an electronic version. And the page numbers on that are off. But it's in that book, and actually I don't have pulled up the electronic version, so I can't even tell you the chapter. But it's in, I think it's in the part, the chapter Dr. Bob Says. So it's kind of in the last half of the book. But yeah, you will find it in that book. And you could probably Google it, Google, you know, Dr. Bob's plaque. I can't guarantee that it'll be, you know, the right, exactly the right words, but you will find it in that book. And it's, like I say, it's a really good book. There's a lot of history, there's just a lot of good stuff. And then the second part, when you asked about in the evening, you know, getting the craving, and I don't really get the craving anymore to eat, I will say. But when I'm disturbed, yes, at any time. But a lot of times in the evening, I'm tired and hungry, angry, lonely, tired, right? Halt. We're more vulnerable. So in the evening, if I am disturbed, yeah, often it's time to do a 10 step. And a lot of times what I'll do if, you know, it's really late is I'll put it on my nightly review, which is the 11th step. And I will inventory it the next morning. I have to be fully transparent. A lot of times it's like I'm tired. I know I have this resentment. I'm sort of making a note of it and or a fear. And then when I wake up the next day during my quiet time, I'll write my 10th step on it. That's just the way I roll because in the morning I'm fresher and I think I can inventory it better. If it's really troublesome, though, I will do it at that time. I realize, okay. You know, I can't sleep on this. I have to do it now. But yeah, whatever time of day there is a disturbance, whenever there is a disturbance, the problem is with me. You know, if I'm resentful at somebody, the problem is with me. And if I have a fear, you know, 99% of my stuff comes down to fear. I have to inventory it and see what is my part. So yeah, thank you for the question.
Yeah, thanks, Elaine. Well, we still have time for more questions if there are any. So please, if you have a question that you'd like to pose to Rachel, press star one, give me your first name and last initial. Who has a question?
Penny,
Jessica R.
Penny and Jessica, I got.
Amy B.
Amy.
Baruchah K. from Toronto.
Baruchah, got you. And anybody else?
Nancy R. in New York.
Okay, Nancy. Gotcha.
Devorah B. from New Jersey.
Okay, let's stop with Devorah, and we'll go from there. So I heard Penny, Jessica, Amy, Baruchah, Nancy, and Devorah. So let's start. You can give your last initial, where you're calling from. That'd be great. Let's start with Penny. Well, we know where you're from, Penny. Good morning. Oh, Penny, press star one.
Oh, somebody went and muted me after I unmuted me.
We do all that all the time. Good morning to you.
I'm a recovered compulsive leader from the Boston area. And Rachel, thank you. I always love hearing about Dr. Bob because I believe that he and I are spiritual brother and sister. In only 9 more days, AA is going to be celebrating Dr. Bob's first day of continuous sobriety. And by the grace of God, I'll be celebrating my first day of abstinence after 38 years. Just God is so good. But my question is, we also share the same birthday. So, I believe you talked about coming to OA as a very young person. Is that correct?
Hi, Penny. Yes, it is. And first of all, congratulations on 38 years. I always love hearing you on the meetings. Congratulations. Happy birthday early. And yes, I came in at 15 years old.
Yes.
My mom had to drive me to my first meeting.
So my question is, I see so many young people, and my heart goes out to them, that are literally obese, including many in my own family. And I know in my area we tried to get young people's meetings, get it in the school, and it doesn't seem to go over. So you said your mother drove you there, do you have any suggestions on how we can help these young people?
Wow, Penny, your question touches my heart. Thank you for your service in trying to carry the message to young people. I have a young person in my family who was in high school, was very young, and tried to kill himself because of this disease by jumping off the roof of the family house. Did not kill himself, was not successful, but mangled his body pretty badly. So this touches me in a very deep way, and I came in as a young person. Honestly, I don't know. I don't know if these concepts can be grasped and understood by young people. And I'm talking like, you know, under 18. Not that there's like some kind of arbitrary cutoff at 18. And then if you come in at 18 in one day, you know, yeah, you can get the program. I don't know. I don't know. I think it's probably possible, but it's very, very difficult. There is so much going on for an adolescent, you know, or a pre-adolescent, you know, in their mind, that grasping these concepts, and they're simple concepts, but they're not easy. I honestly come up with nothing. I don't know. I think loving them, and I certainly think exposing them to the program is not a bad thing. I don't think it can hurt. But I honestly don't know if it's, you know, if it's going to help. But I would say, you know, I'm certainly not against exposing kids to this program. I just don't know if they'll be able to get it until they mature somewhat, and unfortunately have to hurt more. So yeah, that's my answer.
Thank you.
Thanks, Penny. Okay, next up we have Jessica, followed by Amy. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning. This is Jessica R., compulsive overeater from Maryland. Thank you so much. I think, Rachel, for your lead. I cannot tell you how much I needed to hear this morning. My sponsor actually had me read Bob this week, and so I just added the book you mentioned to my Spotify account, which is free on Spotify. And my question for you today is, there were basically four major sections of your talk today. Could you give us those names, please?
Yeah. Hi, Jessica. thank you. You spotted my outline. My English teacher from, I don't know, junior high would be proud of me. I had an outline, or you. So it was basically, I had my introduction. You know, they always say, tell them what you're going to say, you know, say it, and then tell them what you said. So then it was Dr. Bob and me before recovery. And then I had a little part in there about, you know, kind of what happened. Then it was both how Dr. Bob and I were alike after recovery. And then the third part was humility, about Dr. Bob's humility. And the fourth part was service. So thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Jessica. Okay,
thank you.
We have a question from Amy, followed by Baruch. Amy, good morning.
So it's actually Jeannie B from Florida.
Oh, thank you. Okay.
Thank you. So I'm minorly obsessed now with your lava missing, Rachel. So it's, I'm missing one of the A's, but love, acceptance, validation. It's not affection, but it's something along those lines. But my question is, I'm a couples therapist, and there's a bit of this that I'm thinking, is there a balance between a normal amount of those things that we should be giving and getting in the flow of a relationship, in the flow of our relationship to ourselves, and in the flow of our relationship to God? Is it the overuse or dependency on the primary relationship that's the issue? I guess I'd like some clarification on your thoughts about that, please.
Oh, thanks for the question, Jeannie. And by the way, this is the way I heard the acronym is love, attention, validation, and acceptance. And certainly
you
could add like another A in there that would be affection, but or however. And I'm not a trained therapist, so I'm not qualified really to give sort of therapy advice. What I know is for me, because I'm sure we're human beings. We are going to want love, you know, as little babies, we want that. We're social animals. So these are all ideals. Dr. Bob's plaque that he had on his desk, that is an absolute ideal. So, and it says, I think in step 7 in the AA 12 and 12 that, you know, we have these ideals are like perfection, but we're never going to be perfect. You know, we claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. So just because I have an ideal of not seeking that from people, I'm human, you know, I'm going to want that. So I think it's definitely a matter of degree. You know, there's a difference between addiction and dependency and a normal, I certainly, if my boss praises me, I think it's okay to be happy about it. I think it's absolutely fine to be happy about it. But if I make that my drug, if I make that what I'm dependent on, whether my day is good or bad, that's when it moves into that area of dependency and addiction.
Thanks, Jeannie, for the question. And next up is Barucha, followed by Nancy. Barucha, good morning. Star 1, Barucha. Okay,
thank you.
Oh, there you are.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
I can. You bet.
Okay, thank you. Anyways, I want to thank you, Rachel, for such an inspiring talk. And my brain must have taken a vacation because I don't remember what you said about what was on the plaque. So if you could repeat that, I'd appreciate it. And thank you. God bless you all.
Oh, thank you, Barucha. I love your name. So, if that's okay, Larry, I'll just, because it's kind of long, I'll go ahead and read what was on the plaque.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so, I'm at the wrong page. Okay, here we go. So the plaque said, and this is also in the book, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. So the plaque said, this is what humility is, perpetual quietness of heart. It is to have no trouble. It is never to be fretted or vexed, irritable or sore. To wonder at nothing that is done to me, to feel nothing done against me. It is to be at rest when nobody praises me and when I am blamed or despised. It is to have a blessed home in myself where I can go in and shut the door and kneel to my Father in secret and be at peace, as in a deep sea of calmness when all around and about is seeming trouble. Yep, that's it.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you so much, Barucha. Okay, next up we have Nancy with a question, followed by Devorah. Good morning, Nancy.
I'm now unmuted. Thank you, Larry, for your service. Great to hear you always. And Rachel, that was deeply helpful, very beautiful. I'm looking forward to hearing it again. What I want to ask you about is it was great to hear the outline of, again, what you mentioned in this beautiful share. I hear all the things I need to do, and I'm aware of Lava, but it was so wonderful to hear it again. Lava, 10-step, 11-step, working with others, servers, get out of my ego. I feel like there's, if you will, like the dust that keeps piling up, I keep mopping up. It's just like constant, I feel. I'm great to hear about the food neutrality for a long time. I'm so deeply grateful to be abstinent. The question is, you have a list of all the things you do when you're like emergency. Is there a time when you're overwhelmed, when you say, this is what I need right this immediate, instead of going to bed so I don't eat? I mean, if you get what, if I'm being clear, is there a time you're just overwhelmed with all the things that need to be done and feel there's something that can help me immediately, emergency, or is it the constant mopping up? You know what I mean.
Hi, Nan. You must be inside my brain, because my sort of natural default is overwhelmed by stuff to do, and not necessarily program stuff, but I get overwhelmed very easily. Like, oh my God, I've got to do this. I mean, right now I have to catch up for work. You know, I was off a period of time, and I'm like, oh my God, I have so much stuff to do. And I think you're talking about, you know, program stuff, but maybe it's kind of the same thing. And I can't believe I'm actually self-promoting, but I did another special edition that was on doing the next right thing. And so even though this is making me cringe, I would say maybe listen to that, because I talk about just doing the next right thing. You talked about focusing on the next 5 minutes. And for me, when I get overwhelmed, that's what I have to do. Focusing on the now, like God has got everything in the future already taken care of, that, okay, God, I have to ask, what do you want me to do next? When I first got abstinent, I would literally be like, okay, God, what do you want me to do? Okay, get up, wash the dish. Okay, God, what do you want me to do now? Get up, you know, brush your teeth, like just doing the next right thing and keeping it simple. You know, God's, when I hear blah, 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 blah in my head, that's me. Mm. When I hear something that's simple, like, okay, just pray. Okay, make a phone call. Those simple declarative sentences, that's God. So anyway, I hope that helps.
That was gorgeous. Thank you so much. I will listen to the doing the next right thing. Thank you so much. And I'll listen again to this one. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Nancy.
Yeah, thanks, Nancy. Okay, well, before we get to our final question, I'll just let you know, please hang out afterwards for a couple of reasons. One, we're going to get Rachel's contact information. If you feel more comfortable reaching out to her, you can do that. And then I'm also, after the unrecorded hour, once we close, I have a special person I'll briefly talk about the convention we have coming up here. And I think that would be really useful to you. So with that, Deborah, what is your question? Good morning.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, you can. You bet.
Okay. Thank you very much, Rachel. I enjoyed that very much, and I gained a lot from all the questions afterwards. This is my first time speaking up on a vision meeting. I had 5 years of back-to-back abstinence when I joined, and then now coming up on 10 years of relapse, and always with a sponsor, always working the steps. Lately, I have a new sponsor, and I really talk to God a lot and give things over, but I am constantly reaching out for the food. What do you think I'm missing?
Hi, Deborah. Thank you so much for speaking up. You know, congratulations on your first time speaking up in a meeting. That's awesome. That's, you know, it's hard. And I am sorry that you are suffering. I know how you feel, and I have been there. Without, you know, a longer conversation, it's very difficult for me to say, oh, it's this, you know, and it might not be one thing. So, you know, take my number. I am happy to talk with you after the meeting, you know, or I can't right after the meeting. I have another meeting to go to, but But yeah, let's talk. Just take my number. It's just too hard in this kind of forum to really nail down, you know, with detail. But I just want to say, you know, I'm sorry you're suffering. And there are many people on this line who are listening right now who I'm sure can help you and I'm sure can relate.
Yeah, what a great bit of advice there to reach out to folks. And Rachel, thank you so much. It was just beautiful this morning. We're so appreciative of your generosity. So again, we're going to close up the meeting and please hang out for just briefly after we end the recorded portion of our presentation here. Okay, and I am going to give the share ID one more time for Rachel's presentation. That number is 22,483. That's 22483. I'm going to close from the reading from the Big Book on page 164 in a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you.